This Wednesday, there's going to be some dramatic action with the Village of Hope, houseless community, and Portland Tenants United against evictions and sweeps. If you want to be part of a dramatic action at City Council for the houseless and for tenants' rights, 9:15 at Portland City Council Chambers.
I'll be there.
All right. And here we go, off to Prison Pipeline.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
It's now easier than ever for somebody to make and distribute music, but it's much harder to be noticed. It's difficult for me to find the independent artists that I'm interested in through all of the choices. And it's a big part of the responsibility of KWU and other independent cultural institutions to bring attention to new local artists and musicians and help break through that clutter. KWU understands the importance of expression, and we need your help to make a city of media makers where we can all express ourselves artistically and freely. This is the power of KWU. Invest in future media makers and join us on Kickstarter today. Go to kboo.fm/Kickstarter, and thank you for your support of KWU.
KWU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Feet to the Fire campaign Peaceful Protest on Wednesday, February 28th at 10 a.m. at the Clackamas County Courthouse in Oregon City. This peaceful protest happens monthly outside of one of the county courthouses where community members are struggling for justice for their loved ones lost to police violence and hate crimes. These protests remember the loved ones and educate the public about their cases and about the power of district attorneys. Again, that's the Feet to the Fire campaign peaceful protest on Wednesday, February 28th at 10 a.m. at the Clackamas County Courthouse, located at 807 Main Street in Oregon City. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
Good evening and welcome. Testing, are we here? Am I getting audio? Testing. Oh, you can hear me? Okay, great. No, I can't hear myself. Sorry. And Helen, are you there?
Yeah.
Great. Hi. Okay, sorry. Welcome to Prison Pipeline. This is Emma Lugo, and tonight we're going to be talking with Helen. Helen, how do you pronounce your last name?
Caddis.
Helen Caddis, thank you. You've been my friend for so long, but I've always known you as Helen, and I've never asked you how to pronounce your last name. So we're going to be talking with Helen Caddis about the case of Kirsten Blaze Lobato. Kirsten was exonerated after 17 years of being incarcerated for a crime that she did not commit. And we're going to talk about the role that advocates can play in helping to raise awareness about people who have been wrongfully convicted, and how we can get involved in supporting people that we believe have been wrongfully convicted. So, Helen, welcome to Prison Pipeline.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much for joining us tonight. First of all, can you tell us a little bit about the case of Kirsten Blaze Lobato?
Absolutely. Kirsten Blaze Lobato was 18 years old. She was staying in Las Vegas with some friends, and she was in a parking lot of a Budget Suites hotel off Boulder Highway, which is quite a ways from the Las Vegas Strip, when she was attacked by a large man who pushed her down and she had a little butterfly knife, and her skirt at the time, she was wearing a little black dress kind of skirt thing with high heels. And when he pushed her down, she pulled out the butterfly knife her father had given her to defend herself. And she said she just tried to do whatever she could, you know, to defend herself, to get her away from the guy who was trying to attack her. And she said she just grabbed whatever she could and cut, but she doesn't think that she had mortally wounded anyone, because the gentleman, when he, you know, was, you know, when he was deterred by that action, was crying and trying to get up in the parking lot when she drove away. So clearly the man that had attacked her was alive when she defended herself.
So she was,
but this inc-
she was this, she was a victim of an attempted rape.
Yes.
And she defended herself.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And she defended herself. And this was on Memorial Day weekend of 2001. So, mm-hmm. you know, end of May.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And this was this incident was conflated with a completely separate incident that had happened to an entirely different man on a different side of town in a different month.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that sounds ridiculous, because it is. It's
right.
pretty ridiculous.
Right. So
yeah.
the crime that she was tried for was a man who had been beaten to death. And was brutally beaten, and had also had his male anatomy cut off.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes, and it was yeah.
But at the time of that crime, Kristen was at her family's house, which was 3 hours away.
Oh, absolutely right. She was 170 miles away in northern Nevada in a mm-hmm. rural area called Panaca. And she was nowhere near where the crime took place, which was actually across the street from where they were building the Palms Casino,
mm-hmm.
Right off the Las Vegas Strip. And if you've ever been to Las Vegas, one of the things that we used to tell people when we were just presenting an introduction to the case was, if you went to Las Vegas and you book a trip to Las Vegas, you know not to get a hotel 20 minutes from the Strip, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to have the best vacation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If you get a hotel in Las Vegas, you want to get it right on the Strip or right near the Strip. But you don't want to, you know. So where the crime that she was tried for took place was literally right on the Strip.
Right.
But the incident that she was describing was, you know, 20 minutes away from
right.
the Strip, like 8 miles away.
So she was a victim of an attempted rape almost a month prior to this event. And when...
Oh, more than a month.
More than a month. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And when this victim was brutally beaten to death, there was semen on the body.
Oh, yeah.
There were bloody footprints. There was probably some DNA evidence, wasn't there?
I believe there were 13 pieces that were definitely crucial to the case. There was plastic sheeting that had been, you know, wrapped around this victim's body. There were fingerprints on his shirt.
Mm-hmm.
There was a cigarette that was found that had DNA that was never tested. But there was a large amount of DNA that could potentially point to the true, you know, person who had done this, or persons. I mean,
right, or persons. Yeah, it was a very brutal murder.
Crime, yeah,
and the mm-hmm. the person who was killed had been accused of an attempted rape just 3 days prior. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Yes.
And the woman who accused him of rape also had told several male associates at the time. So there were other suspects besides Kristen. So why did the police go 170 miles away and arrest Kristen Lobato? Why did they do that?
Well, she had confided in a teacher of hers named Dixie Tinkin about the incident, because she was very shaken and upset, as a person would be
who
after
had
such an
been
incident.
A victim of an attempted rape, right?
Yes, yes. So she confided in a friend of hers who was a former teacher of hers, and she told her what had happened, and she said that she was afraid of, you know, harming someone, basically.
She was afraid that she had hurt him, hurt the person who had tried to attack her. She was defending herself, but still she was afraid that she had hurt him.
Yes, because she's a very compassionate person. She didn't want to have hurt him. Right. So that was her concern. And I think it's a very noble concern. And her teacher friend said, you know what, I have a friend in law enforcement. Well, this was really a juvenile delinquency officer named Laura Johnson, who I think lived in Pioche, which is a nearby town. And she said, you know, I'll touch base with Laura Johnson and, you know, we'll see if there's anything like that that's gone on, and if anyone's reported an injury, if anyone's been harmed.
So she was trying to find out if anybody had reported or said that they had. She was just trying to find out if the person had been hurt or not.
Yes. Okay. She was just trying to find out, you know, has this person been hurt? And so she went to Laura with that information and gave her the student's name. Mm-hmm. Which is, you know, Kirsten Blaise Lobato, and she had mentioned, you know, an injury to the groin.
Right, to the groin.
And that sort of thing. And so Laura Johnson called the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department with a hot tip. If you have an injury to the groin with a murder, you want to talk to this girl.
Mm-hmm. So this is how she got, this is how she ended up getting wrapped up in this. I mean, it's kind of scary to think that, like, a woman who had been a victim of an attempted rape would then become, like, wrapped up in, like, another completely unrelated crime that she had no connection with. I mean, she was the victim, and now she was being treated as a perpetrator for something that she had no connection with. So she's really being victimized twice.
Absolutely. And for me, when I found out about this case, when I was 19 years old, I was living in Nashville, Tennessee, mm-hmm. Which I believe is where I met you.
Yes, we know each other from Nashville. Many protests standing on Centennial Boulevard.
Many protests, many years.
Yes.
I was actually 19 years old. I had just finished a year studying communications at Antioch College in Yellow Springs, Ohio. And I was very passionate about social justice, but I was also a victim of rape myself at gunpoint when I was 16.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, this struck a really personal chord because I was unable to defend myself. I didn't have any kind of, you know, I didn't have any kind of weapon. I didn't have any way to protect myself at that point in time, and that also happened in Nashville. And I had always wished, you know, if I had been able to defend myself, what would that look like? And to my horror, you know, finding out about this case, wow, if that's what it looked like, right?
Right. Here's a woman who did defend herself. She, like, took action as a woman to, like, exercise her agency and to prevent herself from being even further harmed.
And so she was a hero to me in that she had defended herself. And it was so shocking to me that my first reaction to finding out about her case was, are you kidding?
Yeah.
You know, are you kidding? I had to have it proven to me through, you know, a 60-pound box of trial transcripts that the woman I ended up to work on the Justice for Kirsten campaign with, Michelle Revelle, photocopied for me in an office over the course of maybe 2 or 3 days before PDF
mm-hmm.
in 2003, you know, stood in an office, photocopied all of those, sent me the transcripts, and I sat down and I read them.
Wow. So you actually looked at this case. You wanted to know for yourself the truth of the case before you became, I mean, did you know that it was going to take 16 years of your life too?
No, I had no idea. I mean, mm-hmm. all I knew was that I cared deeply about women's rights. I had actually just read a book, Patriarchy, Notes of an Expert Witness. And who was that by? Ophelia.
Sounds Kessler. Like a great book. A I book. Definitely patriarchy like, notes of a expert witness.
Yeah, sounds by good. Phyllis Chesler. It's probably mm-hmm. one of her best. I had just read that, and I was deeply affected by that book. And I thought to myself, there has to be something that I can do to help another woman so that I can alleviate some of my pain. Because focusing on my pain from what had happened to me, I had done therapy, I had done everything I felt that I could do to, you know, to alleviate that for myself. And so I said to myself, you know, maybe I can, if this is really what I think it is, and this woman is really wrongfully incarcerated, you know, maybe I can use some of the skills that I have, you know, the 19-year-old woman, to help this other 19-year-old woman who's, you know, defended herself and now she's found herself behind bars for a separate crime.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And maybe doing that will give me some kind of peace.
Wow. That's amazing. So it was... that was very deeply interconnected then. It was an experience that you related to that also had something to do with your own trauma. And so you were hoping, like, by helping to support this person who had been traumatized, it was also a way of working out your own trauma too.
Yes. I mean, and in that way, I think that we as advocates and, you know, as activists we can take our experiences and we can use those to help others, you know. And mm-hmm. I mean, I found that in just as a person with that experience, you know, being candid about that with other students when I was in college, or even coworkers sometimes, if it's really, really, you know, if you become very close and, you know, you become friends outside of work and it's on that level. Mm-hmm. I mean, anybody really who mm-hmm. has experienced that kind of trauma may feel more open to discuss that with you, knowing that you've had a similar experience.
Mm-hmm.
And but as an activist, it was something that made me a lot more passionate than I would have been otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's amazing. Mean, and the whole time, like Kirsten, the entire time, she maintained her innocence.
It absolutely, she did.
Mm-hmm. Even after the Las Vegas district attorney, even after she had been exonerated, on the day she was exonerated, was it the Clark County district attorney still tried to defend the position of the original conviction?
Yes. Yeah, and just, you know, I mean, there were a lot of really interesting things that we did as advocates and activists. I'll be honest, I did have to step away to deal with some personal issues in late 2014. And that's just real life, you know. Mm-hmm. But for 12, 13 years, Michelle Revelle and I worked together and did everything we could possibly think of. I mean, everything we could possibly think of, and we
such as what did you do?
Some interesting things we did. Okay, so Michelle started a petition on change.org, asking the district attorney and the attorney general at the time to test the DNA in the case.
Mm-hmm.
Because it has
you mean,
not
you mean they had not tested the DNA tested. Okay,
they still have not
today, they convicted someone, sent them away for life, and they hadn't tested the DNA.
Mm-hmm. Yes, she had 45 to 100 or in some years when we first started on, mm-hmm. On the case. And, you know, I was a web developer, self-taught, started, you know, was in high school when the internet came around in 95 and had mm-hmm. access to computers and Photoshop and all of that. So I've been making websites since I was 13. And so I built them when I decided, okay, I believe you, you know, mm-hmm. this, you know, because I read the transcripts and I said, okay, how could she have talked about this incident prior to it happening? Because the incident happened on July the 8th.
Mm-hmm.
And she had told somebody about the incident at her parents' 4th of July party.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, how can she talk about something that hasn't happened yet?
Right. It was hearsay.
It didn't make any sense.
It was hearsay, hearsay testimony. Third party hearsay testimony was the only basis of her conviction.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. They had a jailhouse informant that hadn't even talked to or met or known in any regard named Corinda Martin, who since passed away. who was offered a deal to she was saying something to the DA about her high risk pregnancy and please help her get out of prison. I believe she'd had a child with a guard. Mm-hmm. It was a long drawn out thing, and you know, there's other abuses of power involved there, obviously, right? Mm-hmm.
Right. So you did a website, and you started a petition on change.org. Those are like two really big, and you also read through all of her transcripts because you wanted to feel convinced. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was important.
Well,
to
there
you.
Was. Yeah, there were all kinds of things that we did. The first year that we were working together, I made the website. I wrote the copy, did the images, did everything, put that up. Started to write to people. I wrote to Han Scherer of Justice Denied magazine, who ended up to write the book about the case and get very involved in advocacy for her on the, you know, in his capacity as an advocate for the wrongfully convicted. Mm-hmm. Han Scherer. Justice Denied magazine is, you know, one of just the most.
It's a great
incredible.
Resource. Mm-hmm. Just like Innocence
Project.
Oh, it
really is. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And he's got a database of every wrongful conviction, I think, from ever. I mean, he's just a brilliant, brilliant mind, and just a very caring and smart individual. And I mean, he pieced together things that we could have never. You know, as just layman's, you know, he's very good at what he does. Mm-hmm. And when he became, I wrote him a, you know, I was writing, you know, emails to people, hey, please take a look at this. We just built a new website. I actually flew out to Las Vegas in the winter of 2003 to share my story and her story together as a speaker at the Under Our Wings Juvenile Justice Conference. Mm-hmm. And I met her in prison in 2003. And then we actually organized a speakers panel in Las Vegas in 2013 called Does Innocence Matter DNA? Mm-hmm. Where the DNA was kind of in the Does Innocence Matter part. And we invited nationally known exonerees to speak.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Jeffrey so you Deskovic, became. You became an advocate, not just for Kirsten, but you became, by working as an advocate on her case, you became knowledgeable in the whole area of exonerees and of justice for people who have been wrongfully convicted.
Absolutely. I actually moved to Las Vegas in the fall of 2012, mm-hmm. from Nashville to take a bigger, you know, actually make a difference in this case. Mm-hmm. Because we had a petition on change.org with 150,000 signatures.
Wow, 150,000 signatures.
That's amazing. Yeah, we had a rally. I flew out to Vegas on the 4th of July weekend in 2012 and organized a rally in front of the courthouse with chanting and signs, and, you know, brought people from all the way from California. And, you know, we did everything that we could think of while I was in Nevada, when I was in Tennessee, but when I moved to Nevada, I'm also passionate about, you know, politics. And, as a lesbian woman, I was very passionate about, you know, gay marriage. And, I became vice chair of Stonewall Democratic Club. I got on the Central Committee of Clark County Democratic Club, Democratic Party. Mm-hmm. And I told people that I met about her story while I was doing that work, because I also have a bachelor's of political science pre-law from Middle Tennessee State University. And I just went, you know, I just took the things that I learned at Antioch College and Middle Tennessee State University, and I did an internship at the American Friends Service Committee National Office in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. In my collegiate career, and marched against the Iraq War in Philly, and passed out buttons "No War in Iraq" on the bus and the mm-hmm. subway. And, you know, I had learned that nonviolent protest how to organize. Is an effective means.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
You learned how to organize, and you also learned how to make political connections, and you took all of that to your work to help free Kirsten.
Absolutely. And I mean, I was up there, I was there in Nevada. I had made little pamphlets and publisher that I was passing out at MTSU when I was a student.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people said, well, why are you handing me this? Well, you need to know. She may be
right.
in another state, but you need to know. This is outrageous. And
yeah.
I went
and
to
you
the National
and
Coalition.
You stayed committed to this for almost the entire length of Kirsten's sentence, which she served 18 years.
Absolutely. And, yeah. I never stopped being an advocate or an activist there's not a point where I didn't believe in her innocence, and there's not a point where I stopped telling people about the case or working for her freedom.
Mm-hmm.
I just stepped away in my official capacity as co-founder of the campaign,
mm-hmm.
because I felt that we had done literally everything
right.
that a person could do.
But
to exonerate her.
So then the Innocence Project came along, and they did mm-hmm. testimony proving that there was no way that the victim could have been killed at a time other than when Kirsten's alibi was effective because of things that I'm not going to say on the air about the corpse. So,
mm-hmm.
so through the work of the Innocence Project and through the work of your efforts and your co-founder's efforts, you're able to keep the case visible and alive. And that helped to, along with the work of the Innocence Project, that helped to free Kirsten. So congratulations.
Thank you. I mean, one of the main things I'd like to tell people before we go is, there were nationally known exonerees who put their names and their reputations on the line for this case.
Mm-hmm.
Kirk Bloodsworth, the first man exonerated through DNA testing off death row in America, went on the radio with William Lopez and Jeffrey Deskovic for her. Jason Pericall, who was wrongfully convicted in Nicaragua. Steve Moore, the retired FBI agent who helped to free Amanda Knox, was deeply involved. Fung Jefferson and J.B. Afomenin stepped in as attorneys and counsel for her pro bono when no one would even touch the case.
Mm-hmm.
And it's those people, it's that team of people who stepped up to the plate when nobody was willing to touch it.
That's amazing.
So where is
Kirsten now? What is she doing now?
Well, last I heard, she was having a really great time with her friends in Las Vegas, getting a manicure. Enjoying her life, going shopping.
I totally get that, yes. Just, mm-hmm. Having just had a really nice gel manicure, I totally get that.
Enjoying her life. And she deserves it. She's a wonderful person.
Yeah, she does.
You know,
is she going to be compensated for her wrongful conviction? And for her?
Now, the civil part of it, it hasn't come up yet. But
mm-hmm.
I would guess that she definitely should be, because there's no reason she should have been behind bars.
Well, Helen, we're almost out of time. Before we go, you were talking about all of the things that you've learned as an advocate and how you've taken those skills and put them to use. And I have to make a pitch, because we are in the middle of a fundraising drive, and we are working right now on a campaign to create a city of media makers, just like you. And so if people want to donate to KBOO, this is a great time to donate. Just go to kboo.fm/mediamakers, and you can go take a look at our website, and you can see what we're doing right now to help promote the same kind of tools that you did, Helen, as an advocate to help promote Kirsten's case. Those are the same kind of tools that we're using here at KBOO to help create more media producers and to democratize media. So I hope that people will consider donating to KBOO at kboo.fm/donate. So Helen, thank you so much for being on KBOO tonight. If people would like to reach you, where can they find you?
They can find me on my website, helencaddes.com. It's helencaddes.com, and I'm a musician. You can check out my latest work.
Great. And if they want to find out any more about Kirsten's case, I know that the website is still up. What is that website?
Her website is justice, the number 4, KIRSTIN.com.
Great. Thank you so much for joining us tonight. I'm Emma Lugo. Please join us again next week on Prison Pipeline. Thanks to our engineer. And again, go to KBOO.FM and look at our City of Media Makers campaign, and please donate. Thank you very much, and have a good night.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the 28th Annual Cascade Festival of African Films from February 2nd through March 3rd. The Cascade Festival of African Films shows us Africa through the eyes of Africans, rather than a vision of Africa packaged for Western viewers. The films represent different countries and cultures and a range of lifestyles from pre-colonial to modern times, including both rural and urban settings. Films include 76 and The Footprints of Pan-Africanism and more at the Hollywood Theater, and The African Who Wanted to Fly, Foreign Bodies, Wulu, and many more at the Moriarty Arts and Humanities Building, Room 104 at the PCC Cascade Campus, 705 North Killingsworth Street in Portland. Again, that's the 28th Annual Cascade Festival of African Films from February 2nd through March 3rd. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of